Culture Rich Conversations on Juno Afternoon is sponsored in part by Mark Stofa and Sarah Hannon of the Alaska Wild Salmon Company, delivering fresh salmon to Juno homes since 2006. Learn more at goodsalmon.com or 907-321-4997.
You're listening to Culture Rich. Culture Rich.
General and a few other topics as they come up. How are you doing, Rhonda?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm good. It's a fantastic, beautiful, sunny day in the city.
It is, and it's interesting to be on the other side of the mic.
I bet, but people have heard from you before. You've done a lot of things for as far as the media and the radio is concerned, but we know you do a great job for us. We appreciate it. Your insights are always very much appreciated, and they're helpful. So.
Well, I enjoy helping out on your show, kind of just being in the background, and I certainly have learned a lot ever since I started working with you guys. I'm sort of on the technical end. I help get your shows on the air, get them technically ready, so to speak, but stay in the background. But I do say that I have learned a lot, and I know that our listeners really enjoy your show.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, that's kind of what we're hoping for, to kind of like raise their consciousness and things from a different perspective, kind of helps people see things from a side they may not have thought of it before. And so we really appreciate that, and glad that you're getting something from the show yourself. What is your ethnic background, Ron?
I am half Japanese.
Okay.
And my mother is Japanese. And my father is kind of a Heinz 57, European heritage, Scottish, Irish, English, maybe a dash of Cherokee Indian thrown in there. But,
wow.
You know, that's my background. And my father is from a small town in, or was, he's both my parents have since passed on. He grew up in Trigg County, Kentucky, which is probably about an hour and a half drive from Nashville and Western Kentucky, a very Southern background.
Yes.
And my mother was born in an island that is today now Taiwan. It was, at the time that she grew up, it was occupied by the Japanese. And her family, after the war, was kind of forced to move from Taiwan to an area that was near Hiroshima, where the bomb was dropped. But that's where she grew up. And so, you know, she had kind of an interesting life.
Yeah.
But she never liked to talk about sort of the cultural upheaval that she went through, sort of the trauma from the war. That was just not a subject that was discussed in our family. And I think it kind of comes from the Japanese ethic of, you know, you buck up, you don't complain, you know, never complain, never explain, sort of ethic. So, you know, I would have liked to have learned more about it, because I definitely think that the trauma from that war affected her. But my father met her in Japan during the Korean War, and she came over to the United States in 1954. And she basically wanted to raise me as an American child, because I think he initially brought her to Kentucky. And that, at that time, was not an environment where interracial marriages were accepted. In fact, you know, the military had strict rules about marrying people from Japan, and whether or not they could even be in the clubs that the military had. There was a lot of discrimination. And I think she made the decision that she wanted to raise me as, quote unquote, an American child for my own good. So I probably didn't learn about her culture as much as I wish I had.
Because she was trying to make sure you but raised in this culture. Yeah, that's okay. So what was, you said 1954?
Right, and I was born in 55.
Okay, so that would have put you right smack dab in the middle of some upheaval here in America as well, right?
Right. I mean, growing I kind of went through, growing up, I went through the 1960s, uh-huh. you know, when I was in junior high, I remember the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Yeah. That, what was that like to live in? I know we, everybody knows, you know, about that, the important historic date in history, but to live in the South during that time, what was it like to experience that? I mean, you're experiencing racism yourself, obviously, and it's but to see that great leader taken down, what was it like just from the people who, you know, the white side, the black side? Like, what were they? What was it like on, for you to experience and go through that as a kid? Did your parents, were they seem to be touched by that? Or
well, at the time, I was living in Prince George's County, Maryland, mm-hmm. and so, you know, we were very much affected by it because after Martin Luther King was assassinated, there was a huge uproar. There were protests, and one black neighborhood in Washington, D.C. was burned. And, you know, my mom had a favorite Japanese store, grocery store that she, an Asian grocery store that she liked to go to that was in one of those neighborhoods. And I always enjoyed that little adventure going into Washington, D.C. And that was a black neighborhood. And it was like seeing two different worlds, the white world and the black world. But I was just stunned to see that neighborhood completely burned and charred. And, you know, it was kind of the beginning of my awareness.
Kind of like a loss of innocence, sort of.
Yeah, well, it was just that something is wrong in this country. Yeah. Something is wrong.
I don't know that. How do I say this? First of all, side question, quick. Were you saying that there was an Asian restaurant, like an Asian sect, like inside the black community?
That's kind of interesting in hindsight.
Yeah, like that is. I mean, I didn't know the population was enough for there to be. Yeah, was it that much of an Asian population in the South in that time?
Well, I don't know why that was, but remember, this was the days before sushi was discovered. That people even, you know, that eating Chinese food was exotic back
then. Right, right, right. Okay.
So I'm sure, you know, I'm curious, what did you hear from like, your grandfather? He is a minister in Anchorage, Reverend Alonzo Patterson. Yes, and sometimes on Martin Luther King Day, he will come and talk about his memories, because he had direct connection with civil rights activists and knew Martin Luther King and moved in those circles. Yeah. What does he tell you about that time?
Be perfectly honest with you, it's similar to how your mother never really spoke about her time. My family, my grandfather included, they were very big on making sure that we understood the scope of what was going on and what the impact on the black community and what it meant to us and what it meant to my generation and passing it down to our own. But details, my grandfather was not a very big on, well, especially when I was coming up. As I've gotten older, we've been a little bit closer in that regard, but not too many details to the kids about that sort of thing. It was a very be seen and not heard sort of thing. So we knew what Grandpa was. We would see what he was feeling about certain things, and when something happened that would strike him as racial or something that he wanted to speak out or did speak out on, it wouldn't be something that he would say to us directly, this is what that was like and this is how I feel. He wasn't like that. He would just move and do what he could for some social or community or something like that to moving that conversation forward. But for us personally, he never really spoke about those sort of things. And my mother, the same way. It seems like those times for them were tough. Just like that, and they didn't want to talk about them. I think the first time I watched something with my grandfather, and it was, for me, because these things are so far removed, I hadn't been touched in the way that they were by racism. And to see a powerful black leader, somebody that you revere, somebody that you had put your hopes and dreams and aspirations in, being inspired by, to see him taken down, I never had that. And so I didn't get it. And then we'd see something on TV. And I think it was, I remember this pretty clearly. I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. The first time I saw my grandfather, like, it wasn't like you could see that there was something there for him in watching that. And for me, it's just like, huh. And for him, it was just like a face change, mood change. Like, and we were just watching something on Martin Luther King. And it's like I said something. I don't even remember specifically what it was. I just remember, like, looking over, and my grandfather was just, everything had changed for him. And so I knew how it affected, I knew that it did, clearly, but to the true scope and depth, I don't think I'll ever know.
You know, and I think until we learn the stories of things that happened, that we really won't have an appreciation for things. And I know that a lot of people think of talking about the hardships and the discrimination as a sign of weakness. And, you know, your show has made me flash back on a lot of things, you know, the things that your mother, Mishari Patterson, and your sister, Christina Michelle, as well as your wife, Kelly Patterson, have talked about, have made me think of things. And I can think of and maybe I would be interested in you following up with this and telling me about what your first awarenesses of racism were, a prejudice. And one of the things is, you know, my father was in the Army, and he went to visit an old Army friend and his family. Mm-hmm. And, of course, his kids were grown, about my age, and they lived in Virginia. So we made this trip there, and the kids were very awkward about me. You know how kids, when they get together, they just suddenly start playing or something. And and so we were going to go to a playground, and this family was a white family. And the young lady said to me, about my age, "Would you mind walking on the other side of the street?"
Wow.
And I
like, why?
What it kind of went, huh? Because Washington, D.C. is a very mixed culture kind of community.
Yes, it
in
is.
The neighborhood that I grew up in, there were Italians, Greeks.
Indian?
Today there is.
A lot,
if you go back to my old neighborhood, people from India, Pakistan, and Somalia, places like that, Africa, populate the neighborhood today. Not so much the Greeks and the Italians. but in any case, it was such a surprise for me, and I didn't, I felt that confusion. For that moment of, I mean, it's something I just put aside because you don't, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, and you're raised to just kind of not let things like that, you know, they're more a reflection of that person, not you. I remember having a conversation with an elder here, a Thlinkit elder, who talked about how when he was a kid, his teacher made him hold stones every time he was caught speaking Thlinkit. And every time that he was caught, he would have to hold out his arms and these stones would go there. And the stones kept getting bigger and bigger every time he, quote unquote, offended. And I said, "How did you deal with that?" And he said, "Well, it reflected on him, not me. I didn't take it personally, and it just became a game to me as to how long I could hold these stones." But, of course, he was one of the culture bearers, the people who kept their language. So, you know, but I think it was also an uncomfortable thing for him to talk about it. I think, I don't know, it's that moment of confusion. You know, you're confused about this, like, have I done something? What's wrong with me? You know, and I'm sort of curious, what was your first kind of awareness of racism?
Okay. Wait.
In your life. I mean, I'm curious, because you grew up in Juneau, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I don't know if I can say my first, but it would have to be. I grow up here. I did have my best friend is white. All of my close friends were white because there's not a whole lot of things there. But it wasn't overt when I realized it, I think it was similar to the same way something that you had mentioned. Like, when you were young, it wasn't that it was right there. It was just kind of confused that you were just different. And that's kind of what it was. I did not realize that was what was going on. And I would have to say sixth grade, maybe. I was in, I went to school at Glacier Valley Elementary. Love that place. And I don't remember if it was me or the other kid or what, but I kind of remember something where the catalyst escapes me. What I do remember was that he used a term, the N-word, as they say these days, and I, at the time, didn't really know what it meant. And I know you're thinking, in fifth grade, you didn't? I didn't. I wasn't sure about that. My parents didn't use it. My they were really big on not using that. And when I got home and mentioned it to my mother, and then that's when I realized, ooh, this is a problem. Because the way that the kid said it was the look in his face, it was, and the way he said it, and I was just like, all right. I mean, to make it all the way to fifth grade and not, I know that was pretty good, right? But it seemed like after that, it snowballed for me. Now, it wasn't that I had terrible experiences. I didn't, but they were, the ones when I was younger were acutely, they acutely touched me right there, because that's when I knew I am different. I knew my hair was different. I knew my skin tone was different, but it's when I realized that I was different and that people were going to look at me different as a result of it.
You know, I kind of had the personality of being a person who liked being different. Maybe it's a flaw. I don't know.
Oh, God, no. I think it's a strength. I tell you what, it's wanting to be different is great. But for me, I really want, when you're one of and you're surrounded by a sea of what it seems like a sea of some of something else, like, why would I would hear these black comedians that I love, you know, all the time, and they'd walk and talk about having a white friend with them, and they'd walk into somewhere in Harlem, and their white friend was like, man, I'm all by myself. And it's like, I look around like, that's exactly how I've always felt, to the point that when I would go down to Louisiana to visit my relatives, when it was more black people and less white people, I would be uncomfortable because I was so used to being around white people. And when you're used to being one of, you want to be normal, and trying to make that happen kind of takes a long road to finding yourself sometimes, because you want to be normal, but normal is, I'm not going to look like that. I'm not ever going to look like that. It's not me. It's not us. My hair products aren't the same. The way, being judged for certain things that, why would they judge you on that? Why would they think you play basketball because you're black? Like, those things fall into place, and you just want to be normal. Sometimes it takes that strength. That you have it inside already, you want to be different. That's a strength.
You know, and I think that thank goodness there were some Lincoln elders that kept their language and decided that you know, they weren't gonna they were gonna stay to their own course, and I think it's easier for children today in some ways because their parents are giving them messages. I mean, I can imagine that your children are being coached to take a lot of pride in who they are and their culture.
I think we know now that it's important to do that here. This Juneau's a safe place. It's a wonderful place. That's what my parents had told us numerous times when we were coming up. It was the reason that we were here. And I would see some of my other family members extended in our age group who were struggling with some other things as a result of being in a different area for whatever reason. You know, it is what it is. So they're sheltered, but sheltered, not sheltered from everything. And so they, my parents were very much wanted to make it important that we did do that. And we did it for our children as well. I don't know if you remember the conversation about hair that we had.
Oh, it was a great conversation. You know, and I've heard from listeners about that.
Yeah.
They're fascinated by it.
It was a great topic, and I didn't realize how much I didn't know until about my own daughter's hair. And it was very informative. And please believe that every day since then, I've told my daughter that she has beautiful hair. I try to say it every morning, but I don't always get it. But I tell her she has beautiful hair every day, baby. You got beautiful hair. Daddy loves it, and it helped greatly the tips that she gave because she was so informative.
Yes, your guest was a long time stylist, Kiala.
Mm-hmm.
She called herself a black hair professional,
right,
because she did many, many other things, design wigs, mm-hmm, and things like that. Yes. I think that show was a real eye-opener that those kinds of black styling salons were a haven, mm-hmm, for black culture, where people could be themselves.
Yeah, very much so. I'm surprised that sometimes you ever seen or heard of the movie Barbershop with Ice Cube? You ever heard of you ever
no,
seen that?
I
no,
haven't.
Okay, he's got a movie. I'm sure some of our listeners have definitely seen it. He has a show called Barbershop, and I was really surprised at how accurate he was able to keep the barbershop feel true to form. It really was like that. It didn't seem like exploitation of it. It was like a snapshot of what actually goes on there. And I thought it was really wonderful. He did a really good job because it is like that. It's a little haven, and it's a safe place. And I remember as a young, and not having that experience here in Juneau, to going out into the States, and it's been a big deal for me my entire life. That when I leave here, I go get my hair cut, and it's probably the only thing I could say my entire life that I ever tipped anybody. Because my wife, I'm sorry, honey, has got me into tipping recently. She tells me I'm a jerk for not doing it. I'm much better now. But at the time, my barber was the only guy because it was the feeling that he gave. And going in that shop, and I'd be a little nervous because I'd never been in there when I was younger. And it was that you can just kind of be yourself and you can crack these jokes and you can say these things. And at the same time, you kind of get the pulse of the street, right? You can get the pulse of the feel of the people in there because they are all the same color, so to speak. They're different hues, but all the same color. And it was great.
I think that show, if people who are listening now haven't heard that show, we do keep our shows online, and so go to that page. There are a couple of shows on this subject, and they are just amazing because you will find out things you never imagined. And that's what I like about the show. One thing I did want to ask you about, while we're flashing on the past, is there's a documentary that's out called The Summer of Love.
Okay.
And it was about the music festival in Harlem that took place, and no one ever heard about it because all the attention goes to Woodstock, which also happened that summer. And I'm fascinated by that. You see this sea of black faces and this really robust music. Uh-huh. And it's like, we never heard about it. This footage is out for the very first time.
I feel like that's a microcosm of how it typically is, right? Something that is done by a minority community, typically black, just because of we are in America, but it's a minority community. And then if there's something parallel to it that's done by the mainstream, you completely dismisses it. Better, worse, you'll never know because we never hear about it. There's no footage. There's no this. There's no that. And then Summer of Love. Actually, I have seen that film. By the time I saw it maybe a few years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. By the time I saw it, I wasn't surprised. I had never heard of it before. I thought it was something else. When we were watching, we were about to watch it, someone else brought it up. We watched Summer of Love. I definitely thought it was like Summer of Sam, some sort of joke. And I was just like, okay. And then it's like, oh. Educated me myself. I was unaware. And some of the artists that they had on there, it was a black Woodstock. But with much less violence.
Well, it was amazing because it was very unlike Woodstock. It was very much a family event.
Right. That's why. It was much less violence. It was like the feel that Woodstock claimed that you were going to get, and you really got it there. And maybe that's why. Maybe that's why I sort of not being put on the mainstream. But that was where I realized that rock and roll was, even though this didn't, I had no obvious stirrup, a whole hive of worms through that, rock and roll was taken out of the black community, and I didn't really realize that either. I had no clue. I honestly thought that that was just, you know, I know jazz and anything, but you don't really take it all the way back there. That rock and roll was taken out of the black community, and you, I'm surprised that I was surprised at how much we had to do with that, and then see it front and center. All those great bands, all those great guests. It was phenomenal, phenomenal, absolutely.
Well, I would love to watch your mother watch that, because I know how much your mother likes music.
She does.
It would be interesting to see how she would respond to that.
Yeah, I'd have to leave. I think she'd love it. I think she would too. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if my mom had been there, okay? Okay, she just, oh, well, by the way, honey, I just never talked about this.
Well, I think she was there in spirit.
Yeah, know, absolutely.
For sure. But I thought that that was so interesting, that that was like a forgotten chapter in our history. And that just tells you that something is not right about that. That we, you know, it's just like recently there was some stories that came out about Black Wall Street and this community, you know, that was bombed, and it was a thriving community and burned, and no one ever heard about it. It's like there's so many things that we never learn.
I'm embarrassed to say that I learned about this maybe 5 years ago. And I blown. It's actually changed how I viewed, and I mean at a deep level, how I viewed the capabilities of the black community, honestly. I've always felt that we, the black community, by some fault of our own, by some, you know, some things we could not control, have always been splintered. We've never been very good at cohesively coming together as a unit, and this is nationwide. And a lot of that we had to do with Sir. A lot of that people came in, and it was made that way for us, trying to keep us, because, you know, stronger together, so let's keep them apart. Black Wall Street, and for those listeners who are unaware, this is a place in Oklahoma.
Right.
And it was a rich, a wealthy African-American, I think real estate, or how he amassed his fortune this time. This is back in...
It was like a little city.
Yeah, it was a little city. I don't want to get it wrong. I believe it was 18... Maybe, oh, Lord. I'll get the date. But it was a little pocket.
And of prosperity.
They said that in Black Wall Street, that there were, in for the area surrounding it, there were three airports. In those airports, of the entire population, two of those planes were owned by black families. Now, you can understand that at that time, they owned airplanes. These are doctors and lawyers and engineers, and they were famously and fantastically wealthy at that time in a pocket surrounded by people who were not. And what started it was that a gentleman was accused of sexually assaulting a white woman. And it started from there. She said he did something, then they went to court. And the people surrounding that area were so upset that they began to run to go. They started with the court building and working their way out. And, of course, they set their sights on this pocket of black prosperity and just burned that place to the ground. And I lost a little bit my way, that the black real estate agent, for those who are trying to follow us here, is what he had done is he had purchased a large parcel of land and only sold it to black families. And that's how that gave it the roots and allowed for it to grow. And so only here and there, and it was, I don't remember the exact stretch of it, but yeah, it's a phenomenal. If you've never heard of that story, please look it up. It's amazing. And I had no idea until I was 32 years old. They didn't even exist. I didn't know that was possible. And me and my son have had conversations at length about Black Wall Street, because I was like, that's not going to happen with you. Like, you're not going to find out in your 30s that was something that could happen, you know, and that did happen. And then the reasons why it failed. And because ultimately it didn't fail. It was taken from them. Yeah, that was a tough one. It's amazing, but I think at that point we'll take a break on that note, Rhonda.
All right.
We'll be back to talk with you about maybe some more about rural Alaska. I'm Michael Patterson, and you're listening to Culture Rich Conversations. To Culture Rich Conversations. I'm Mr. Michael Patterson. I'm talking with Rhonda McBride. And we're talking about a wide ranging assortment of topics today, aren't we?
Oh, boy.
It's kind
oh,
of,
boy.
kind of span the gamut here. for those of who were listening before we stepped away, we were speaking about Black Wall Street, a place in Oklahoma. Where there were a large, successful section of the population from the Black community was living, and it was ultimately bombed and burned down as a result of some social upheaval over the alleged sexual assault of a Black man on a white woman, which is a firebomb back in those times. I mean, you look at them. And that was all it took. When we left, I was saying that I had been speaking with my son about Black Wall Street in particular. I didn't learn about it until I was in my early 30s, and I didn't want that to happen to him. It's not something they teach you at school. And the reason for that is... I mean, for me, it's obvious. My son grows up here too. He is Black, and we don't have the same. The curriculum doesn't shine that hard on what's not the what I guess I feel are the mainstream Black topics. Right? He'll learn about Malcolm X. He'll learn about Martin Luther King. I think to a certain degree they get. Not dumbed down, but it kind of gets, this is what they say, and this is this. And so you really want to find out other things. We have to dig deep. And we're trying to make sure that he, it's something that he wants to find out about, because it's easy to just sit back and not. In that vein, we kind of were looking, I kind of wanted to ask you a question, Rhonda. Is there something similar? Because I've seen a lot of similarities in the issues that the Black community have experienced as in America, and a microcosm of that being something similar to the Native community here in Juneau or in Alaska, so to speak. Do you see any parallels there for yourself?
You know, I do see some parallels, and to me, that's very fascinating. They're different experiences.
Of course.
Because, for example, Alaska Natives were on their own land,
right.
And you know they're fighting for rights
yeah.
that they had on their own land. Where African Americans, you know, were brought
right.
on slave ships and had a totally different experience, yeah, of just kind of being ripped from their motherland and having to adapt. But some of the issues are the same, and I've always been kind of fascinated by how Alaska Natives kind of look to Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders to emulate, sort of, because Martin Luther King, if you think back on it, was very dignified.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when I look back at old footage of him, he's always wearing a suit,
mm-hmm,
and just dressed to the T. And this past year, we were looking back at the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act,
mm-hmm,
the 50-year anniversary, mm-hmm, in which Congress passed a law that gave a rather restored certain rights to the land. They didn't restore everything. It was a bargain that really Alaska Natives did not get to the good end of the bargain, but it did give them title to some of their land. So it restored some of what was taken from them. But in that footage, as you look back, you know, 50 years, you look at some of the Alaska Native leaders like Emil Nadi and Willie Hensley, there's a dignity with the way people carried themselves in the face of such insulting,
yeah,
reception.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the testimony of what was said, and you wonder, too, how people like Martin Luther King could conduct themselves in the face of such insults.
Yeah. It's
an onslaught.
Yeah, and relentlessly, too. It was a relentless onslaught to continue, to keep coming and coming, and for them to maintain that. I'd imagine it had to have been much harder for the Alaska Native people because, like I said, it's your land. It's your land. Like, you're like, get off, man. Like, you know, and then to come over and have it treated like that, it seems like so many major movies that show something that involves some people coming from somewhere else. My son's favorite movie is Avatar, of all time. And follow me on here. Follow me. But every time I watch that movie, it's the same thing. It's these people come over and they're trying to take from a beautiful community, from a beautiful culture, that believe the earth and the land and everything is one. And these guys come over and just trying to extract it for riches. But they have bigger guns, so they win. And my son, for the longest time, is like, I don't see it. And I can't help but, because that, as I said, I always thought that it's had to have been much more difficult at that time, because everything is fine. And then another people come over and they decide for you what's going to happen. And technology changes, it separates those things. It allows us to proceed. And having to, the fight for that must have been much, much more difficult in that regard than for us. Because like we said, we got pulled over from somewhere else, but it was not on our own soil. And even today, I think that it feels like in Alaska, because of outside of the great, great programs that the Native peoples have, Alaska Native peoples have set up for their own, which we could learn from, and NAACP could get on board. it seems like there's the treatment of the Alaska Native people. Some I've always paralleled down in the States versus here, that how black people seem to be viewed down in the States is sometimes how the Alaska Native people could get viewed and treated here at home and in Alaska. That's just some of the slurs that I've seen even coming up in school. It was a little big, because there's only like 5 black people, right? So it was in my class. I graduated a class of 500. It was me and one other guy that were black. But the population here is much higher for Alaska Natives. And so the slurs are there. It's just mind-blowing that instead of nigger, it was something else, right? and it's almost the same. How do you... It the outrage has got to be much more. And in the Native community, I don't know, nobody's ever talked to me about this, but the outrage has got to be the same to be treated like that still in this day on your own soil Am I riffing here, or do you?
Well, you know, I am not Alaska Native, but yeah. I guess I've been very lucky to have worked in predominantly Native communities like Bethel. I worked there for 10 years for the public radio station KYUK, and also the newsroom that I worked in was bilingual, and half the staff was Yupik, and half the staff were English speakers. So. It was really interesting.
Exclusively Yupik.
Exclusively
Yupik.
No
kidding, okay.
And, you know, their job was to do broadcasts, do the news in Yupik. And there were very different cultural things that were involved in doing the news. It was really eye-opening for me. I remember there was a young, at that time, Native broadcaster, and he was trying to learn how to do news. And he said, you know, news is against everything my culture teaches me. Mm. You're not supposed to say bad things about people. And he says, that's all news is. And I went, oh. But, you know, maybe that gentleman's name was Adolf Lewis Kakianuk, and that was his Yupik name. But that was, you know, that was something that made me think a lot.
Yeah. Just having to do things kind of against against what you're
against his culture,
right? Yeah.
But he did a very good job because he also saw news as a way to help his culture to tell those stories. But you know, when I think back on these things, I think one thing that is very different is that the civil rights movements for each group came about at different times.
True.
And Alaska Natives have been able to leverage. You know, their unity through groups like the Alaska Federation of Natives, tribes, and then, of course, the Native corporations like, you know, Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which was born from a Native corporation, and all the wonderful things that they're doing to preserve language and culture. And, you know, they've come a long way from the elder David Katsik, who told me this story about holding out the stones in his arms to just, you know, you can just see children in the Tlingit language and culture program just bursting with pride when you see them perform, that they're so full of this joy of being who they are. So it is a different time. And, and I see that, you know, in the African-American community, this, you know, and some of the shows that you've done, like, for example, the one on the historically black colleges and the black fraternities and sororities, and how they really focus on building pride in their culture. Yeah. And, of course, you know, you've done shows on Kwanzaa, so many things.
Pride, that's a big one, pride. I think that's really what it is, trying to make sure that we are passing that on to our generations. Future generations, present generations, and looking back to our past to kind of see what they did to make sure that we could hold our head up in that regard and see that fight. I think that definitely that want for pride for our future is probably definitely what brings both of those both of our cultures together in that regard and that pursuit. So,
and so from my 1960s perspective, yes, there still are a lot of things that haven't been fixed.
You know, of course not.
You know, you have talked on your show about the aftermath of George Floyd's death, and we still see black men dying, you know, at the hands of law enforcement in very questionable circumstances. Deaths that didn't need to happen. You know, so these things are still going on. It's not a perfect world.
No, but it's never will be. If we're looking for perfection, we're going to always be disappointed. What we're looking for is progress. And I believe that we're making some. But progress is slow. Progress is a slow change. True change is not fast. True change takes effort. It takes time. And it takes a whole lot of people changing the way they think, changing the way they move, and then allowing themselves to pass that down truly to those who are going to come behind them so they can carry on that work. And I think that we're starting to see more of that. I believe that we'll see some the results of the seeds we're putting in now. I think my son's generation, the generation after his kids, so on for that, I think I'd say two generations away is where we're really going to see real fruit. That's just my personal opinion. But I do, and I am pleased with the fact that there I am seeing this in little small ways here and there. People are looking a little bit differently at stuff. People are thinking a little bit, and they're asking questions that they have never asked before. And I think, honestly, stuff I never thought would happen, it truly is. So I think we'll leave it right there.
You know, I do want to say, though, I think a lot of my hope is that people are telling their stories, that we're becoming aware. You know, in the Native community, you have leaders like Jim LaBelle, who have been telling the story of what happened to Native kids that were whisked out of their homes in the villages and sent to boarding schools under very racist, very punishing circumstances. Were, you know, there were some good boarding school experiences, but there were some darker ones. But people are coming out and telling the stories so that we understand what people went through. I think that's a good thing. And I always applaud people for their bravery, but it gives me hope.
And hope. It is shining a light on those stories to get them out there, because information, knowledge is power, right?
Right, and that's what this show has been doing, the Culture Rich Conversations, is it's rich in stories.
Informative, and trying to drive that conversation forward. That's what we're hoping to do, and which we're hoping we're in the process of doing. So thank you guys for listening today. It's been really fun to sit and talk with you, Ronnie. It really has.
It's been fun talking with you, Michael.
It really has. Man. You're a wonderful person. You're so, you know, bright and full of your fish for yourself. And I absolutely, genuinely love this conversation we got to have.
I love your family and the good work that you're doing with Culture Rich Conversations. It's been fun to chat with you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm Michael Patterson, and thank you for joining us for Culture Rich Conversations, a collaboration of the Black Awareness Association of Juneau and KTOO. Until next time.
You're listening to Culture Rich. Culture Rich.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.